just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm librarian, I'm a librarian, and I like it quiet so the pages can be burned. I'm a librarian.
You are listening to The Library Show on KCAW Raven Radio, and I'm Sarah Bell. But you may be listening to Raven Radio in Sitka, but this program is being recorded in Seattle. So if you hear some alarms or some the sounds of maybe an ambulance going by, never fear. Everything's all right. We're just in a different location recording this. My guest today is Courtney Estabanen, a painter and artist for as long as I've known her, but she's gotten really serious about it. But part of being a painter is really exploring the field and studying what other painters have done, learning from them, incorporating that into your own sense of art. So that's what we decided to talk about today, because she has a painter that she's gained some enthusiasm for because he's interesting. He's a contemporary Norwegian painter. I'm not even going to attempt to talk any more about him. I'm going to turn it over to you. Well, welcome, Courtney.
Well, thank you. I'm Sarah's sister, by the way, so if we get a little giggly, we have decades of
giggling
sisterhood behind us. Yeah, I've just started my art career about 10 years ago. I've been studying at Gage Academy in Seattle, Washington, working with some very interesting painters. I've done some workshops with New York painters and Italian painters that have come, or drawers. So this last summer, I spent studying with Jim Phelan, who is a Northwest painter and sculptor. And he is he paints in a traditional style. And all throughout the class, he would make reference to several painters. Of course, one of the greatest that he loves is Rembrandt. And then Odd Nordrum follows in that line. There's also Velasquez. And, of course, those are the people that we looked at most of the summer. And very interestingly, this was a painter that when I started my drawing about 10 years ago, I wasn't impressed with him. I found his stuff a little dark. But as when I turned into painting, I found out here's a man that really, really uses paint in a very descriptive manner. And what I mean by that is you can take a canvas or a board and you can paint in oils and you can paint it perfectly flat. So when you go up to it, you can see it as clearly as when you stand back 20 or 30 feet. Then there are people like Rembrandt, who in his later career used the texture of the paint to describe form. He would put it on very thickly. He would make his strokes or his palette knife follow the form. And then one of the techniques he would use would be, for example, when he was doing portraits, he would paint it light, and then he would go back in and glaze. Now, glazing is a technique that was in use... Oh, gee, I guess when they started painting, and what it is, and painting sort of, oil painting sort of started, and they attribute it to like the 1300s or 1400s. Glazing is where you take your medium, which is oil, and then you have the pigment, which is the ground powder or color, and when you glaze, you put a large amount of oil with little pigment. So it's like a wash. It's like watercolor. So Rembrandt, and if you take a look, I have one of his beautiful self-portraits on my phone. You can see that where he applied, for example, he may have put an alizarin crimson red over, and then he wipes it out. So it goes into the dips and the crannies and the cores and the cracks, the pockmark, and it looks like skin. And we know that skin isn't opaque. It has light goes in and reflects through different layers. On your forehead, there's very little fat, so the color's different. You know, you've got your skull right below it, and then on your cheeks, there are many more blood vessels, so light goes in and reflects back out. So to have a painting or portrait that looks very lifelike, the use of glazing and multi-layers and scraping back creates something that's very vivid and very alive. So Odd Nerdrum, so let's go back to Odd Nerdrum. Odd Nerdrum.
So it, Courtney has, I need to just comment that our visitors, our listeners, don't see what we're seeing. So you have a beautiful book.
I have three of his books. I have Odd Nerdrum paintings, which are the paintings of his early career. I have a book called Crime and Refuge, and then I have one called Kitsch, More Than Art. Now, for those people that don't want to particularly buy the book, you can go onto YouTube and put Odd, like Odd, O-D-D, Nerdrum, N-E-R-D-R-U-M, and you can hear, you can see his paintings, he's been interviewed. He also, his school, the students spoke a lot at the track conference, so you can listen to him and see him and hear his students, and track is the realist art something convention. And I think he was in the 2014. So you could YouTube, if you're interested in hearing him, you could also look up his work. Odd Nerdrum is a very interesting character. He was born in Norway in 1944, and he's considered a figurative painter, which means he paints people, as opposed to still life or landscape.
Well, and as I'm looking at the cover of the book, Odd Nerdrum, I'm not sure who it's by. Painting. It does bring Rembrandt back. I mean, I look at that, and that brings me to that era. So it's not photographic, but it's highly realistic, I guess. Is that a good description?
We call it painterly.
Okay.
You know, because there's what happened in the 1800s, there was... Well, Odd Nerdrum is reacting against this. In the end of the 1800s, they basically, the art world, particularly in France, that led throughout all the tradition that went before. Nerdrum says it comes out of the philosophy of Kant and Hegel and the German philosophers. And you will remember that there was Courbet and there were Cézanne. They were the beginning ones that threw out this tradition of painting where the painter was a craftsman. He wasn't an artist. He was a craftsman. He worked under a master painter. He learned the trade. He stretched the canvases, prepared the panels. He ground the pigment with the oil, because you would buy pigment as a powder form, and you'd have a mull and a glass or a marble plate, and you'd put your pigment down, which is like dirt or ground mineral, and then you would add oil slowly to it, and you would mix it for the day, because there weren't tubes. So it was a craft that had been passed on for centuries, and then all of a sudden it was put under question. You know, we had after the French Revolution, things were pretty much overthrown, and the first thing, of course, everyone knows about Impressionism, and then that was followed by Post-Impressionism and Pointillism, Surrealism and Nabi and Modernism and Postmodernism, and there are all these isms that came to the forefront after the 1800s. And so to the point of conceptual art. And one of the things that, you know, you conceptual art, Duchamp, to show you, he came to New York and brought a urinal and signed it and said, this is art. Mm-hmm. So what is art? It has thrown out all the tradition. Kant basically said, it has to be new, it has to never been done before. And Odd Nerdrum did not follow that tradition.
Well, you threw in a term, kitsch, which we had talked about before, when we were just talking about this subject, and of course I grew up thinking something that was kitschy was really sort of commonplace and like the big-eyed paintings, the Keen paintings, and that kind of stuff. And so Odd Nerdrum had sort of adopted this. And you had a quote you were going to read.
Well, kitsch traditionally is a derogatory term meaning cheap decoration. Right. And this is in his book on kitsch. He describes it, and he has a whole movement, and he a manifesto on kitsch. And it's in this book. But he it's called Kitsch, More Than Art. So art was defined in the 1800s as anything goes. It could be, you know, a white canvas. It could be, you know, Jackson Pollock dripping. That's what the critics called art. And he was basically and soundly, you know, chastised for trying to paint in the tradition of the Greco-Roman and that's the philosophical basis, but he would paint in the tradition of Velasquez and Rembrandt and some of his favorites. So here's, it's called Art in America, and it's one of the first articles in his book on kitsch, and it says, and this is a quote, "I was at a party. We were sitting around a big drinking table. At my side sat an African-American curator from the modern wing of the Modern Museum, New York. We talked about art and aesthetics. It was really nice. I asked her, what is lacking in modern art? I mean, what has been thrown away? Well, she said, maybe there's something, but I really like modern art. What do you think is lacking? Her eyes were anxious, and she couldn't wait for my response. Well, I said, what about a timeless sunset? Oh, she shook her head. That's far from art. Warm, wonderful skin and a sensible face with eyes engaging you. Oh, that's too sentimental, she said. Fine craftsmanship? I would say more than that. Poetic craftsmanship? What? She asked, astonished. A loving couple sitting on a bench. Inconceivable, she exclaimed. A woman nude and wonderful, her eyes saying, come, my love. She laughed, but this is kitsch. So he took that as an indication that the things that he cherished would be called kitsch. And so he embraced that term to mean a continuation of the artistic tradition before Impressionism, you know, the early 1800s. And he read a lot of the German philosophers, and he didn't really understand them. But and he had this great, great sort of aha moment when he saw Caravaggio. When he, in his 20s, he went down to Italy and saw how beautifully he painted. And he realized that the influences that were affecting him were in conflict with the abstraction and conceptual art, which were dominating the market. So he created a manifesto on kitsch, and this is the book. He's very well known for his limited palette, which means he works the palette of the old masters. It was before the synthetics were created. In the 1600s, there you had your earth tones and your reds were not your cadmiums are your cad yellow, red, and blue and orange are very, very brilliant, but mm-hmm. those are synthetic and they've been created recently. So his palette is basically a white, a yellow ochre, an earth red like an English red, which is a red iron oxide, and maybe a black, because when you mix this black and white, make blue and red make purple.
Right.
Red and you can make pinks. Red right. and yellow make orange. Yellow right. and blue make green. So you have your whole palette, but in a very, very unified thing. So he paints in a traditional manner, which means he paints on canvas and he grinds his paints. And they were talking about his method, and I'm quoting from what he says, or a translation of what he said. When I paint, it's as if I'm struggling in the water. I'll do anything not to drown. I'll use sandpaper, rags, fingers, palette knife, not brushes, whatever it takes not to drown. So he started his career, and his paintings are usually quite large. In the beginning, they were multi-figured. And they have these very sort of surreal landscapes. Well, I'm sure most everybody's taken Icelandic air, right? And we have a stopover. Stopover this Martian landscape. He actually went there and lived there and was in exile there for a while. And you can see in his paintings a sort of Martian, treeless,
right, barrenness,
barren, and the sky, sort of that northern Nordic, right. You know.
I was thinking, because we talked a little bit about how it is barren and cold and subdued, and that is reflected not only in painting, but in what is coming out of Norway and Sweden and Denmark, mm-hmm. in terms of literature. It's getting translated. And now, popularly, there are these mysteries and thriller kinds of books. So that same mood mm-hmm. Shows up in literature. So it's not surprising that it shows up in his art.
Sort of apocalyptic. I mean, right. You see his paintings and you... The more recent ones, there are some of them, find them very grotesque, but they're beautifully painted. So he has a very interesting history, and one of the things that people love to talk about is his conviction. Odd Nerdrum, his paintings are very large, they're very heavily painted, and when you paint in oil, they have this thing called fat over lean, which means your earliest layers... You use like a turp or a mineral spirit,
turpentine,
okay. Or a mineral spirit that you can thin out your paint. And of course, we know oil paint has oil. And as you build your layers, you put more and more oil. So if your first layer down is really oily and then you put drier layers on top, the paint can't cure, which means the paint on the outside cures or dries or whatever, forms a crust sooner, and then the other doesn't,
right.
So he used an experimental medium.
And what was the little term, lean over?
Fat over lean.
Fat over lean. Okay.
So your outside layers are fat. They have more fat oil in them. So he tried an experimental medium. And, I mean, his pictures sell for hundreds and thousands of dollars. I mean, now he's very... And a couple years into it, the paint was sliding off the canvas, literally. I mean, and so people were bringing these things back, and his gallery said, we got a real problem here. And one of the ways he did it was he refunded the money or he repainted it for them. And so his gallery says, I'm not going to represent you unless you have money in escrow. So he took $2 million and put it in a bank account and didn't declare it as income. So the Norwegian government, he says they're after him. And he's gone to trial a couple of times, and they finally convicted him as tax evasion. He said it was not earned income because he couldn't use it, and they said he should have declared it. He said it was escrow for, if his...
Painting
fall off, slide off. And so he was convicted, and he was in prison for 2 years, and he wasn't able to work because you're not...
Oh, he wasn't able to paint even because that was... Well, that's interesting, but anyway.
So he's a real character, and he's done... Most of his stuff is figurative, which means there's figures in them, and some of the... I just think they're absolutely exquisite. If you're a painter... And you can go to his paintings and ask the painting questions. And the Fry Museum in Seattle, Washington, which is all the work was given, the museum was given by the Fry family. It's a free museum. You can walk in. And they own an Odd Nerdrum. And just out of curiosity, I asked if I can see it. They said, oh, yeah, no problem. So, ladies and gentlemen, use your museums because I was able to see some original Fetchen drawings. The curator said, oh, let me show you this. Anyway, I went back with two teachers, and they pulled, most museums have huge storerooms. They pulled their Odd Nerdrum out of storage, and we were able to look at it up closely, and yeah. It's an amazing painting.
And you made a comment about his colors that you observed. Not knowingly.
Yeah.
I mean, this may or may not be so, but supposedly he only used the three primary yellow, red, green, I guess.
And I was there with Juliet Aristides, who's an atelier teacher at Gage. She also has 4 books out on painting, and she studied with Jacob Collins, and she knows Odd Nerdrum, and she was at TRAC, which is what I told you, the Realist Artist Convention or something,
right?
And in Southern California a couple of years ago, and she was talking to him, and she said, "Well, can you show me? Will you?" He said, "Yeah, I'll mix it up for you. Get the paint." So she says he was on the top floor. She ran all the way down. She didn't take the elevator, hoping she could grab some paint and meet him. And she grabbed the tubes of paint and her palette and met him, but someone had whisked him away. But his contention is that he doesn't use any other. But we saw something what looked like CAD orange. You know, it was just a swipe of it.
But, so maybe he slips a little in there.
Who knows? Who knows? He's a real character. He's fun to read about. He's very influential now in the art. And there is a tendency, a trend now to come back to figurative painting. There's a lot of the good stuff coming out of New York is figurative and imaginative, and it's highly influenced by gaming. You know, a lot of the guys that are doing it are doing fantasy paintings with dragons and caves and flames and gold leaf, but they're using the traditional method because these schools, these atelier programs have been around now for 30 or 40 years, and it's influencing the art market.
So what are the 3 books that you have here if people are interested in reading more about Odd?
About Odd, yeah. Okay, well, you know, these are rather expensive art books, so...
But that's where libraries are great, right? Because you can usually, if they don't have them, perhaps get them through interlibrary loan.
That would be an excellent
idea. I never discourage people about talking about books that are maybe not accessible in their local library. They can usually...
Well, see if you can get anything on Odd. The ones I have now, the one is called Crime and Refuge, Odd Nerdrum. Then the one that I've been reading that has his manifesto is Kitsch, More Than Art, because remember, he's redefined kitsch as traditional painting, because the art market has hijacked the word art, and he doesn't want to be associated with.
Right.
And the third one is Odd Nerdrum Paintings, and I think there are probably 7 or 8 books out. I also recommend going online to YouTube and Googling Odd, O-D-D, Nerdrum, N-E-R-D-R-U-M, listening to him talk at the TRAC convention or watching some of the videos. He's really interesting, and I think that he's a brilliant painter, and I think he will be one of the painters that will be in the Hall of Fame for this century.
So do you spend a lot of time looking at books about other artists? And if so, you know, why? What do you get from reading about their experiences or looking at their, you know, photos of their paintings?
Well, I'm studying in a tradition that says we stand on the shoulders of those that went before us. And so this whole educational system, when I went through art in the art department at the University of Washington in the 70s, there was no technique taught. There was, you know, just do it, you know, do it. And you're making art if you just take a brush and, you know, slap. And so I'm involved in this other tradition that says let's go back and stand on the shoulders, because why reinvent the wheel? If they've already done this, if they found a way of to simplify and still make it effective, why would you want to recreate it? And that's sort of this issue where the term art in the early 20th century is, we don't look at anyone else's work. You know, it's all, if it's not new and original, then it's not art. And, you know, there's all sorts of conflicts going on saying that, you know, that the art market is more an investor, where one of the greatest artists in the 1800s, which we talked about before, was Alphonse Bouguereau. In his long life. He only painted, you know, there may be 700 paintings available for sale on the market, where I think,
Picasso,
let's see, well, they have, Andy Warhol has 35,000 things for sale, and Picasso has 180,000 items. So the art market is driven by an investment economy. So that's another issue here. And so I do look at Seattle's sort of a desert as far as looking at fine art, the period that I'm interested in, because to collect old masters, you had to do it in the 1800s or 1900s,
right.
So they're very expensive now. There are some very fine pieces in private collections. Paul Allen has some, and we see his work occasionally. most of this stuff, if you wanted to study this, you would study in Paris, where a lot of it was done, or the Met, New York, or the Frick.
Well, the reality for purchasing something like that for a museum collection, they're very expensive. So the old masters didn't turn out the quantity. They turned out beautiful paintings, but the consequence is that their work is probably pretty prohibitive to purchase.
Well,
and I suppose there's a lot of museums, perhaps things you'll go in and you'll see they're on loan from some family collection.
Yeah. And there's just a new thing in the newspaper this last week about this American couple that gave this huge collection to Orsay. They gave Impressionism and Nabby paintings, huge collection, 240 paintings. Instead of leaving it in the U.S., they convinced them that more Americans would see their paintings in Orsay than if they gave it to an American museum. So we have very few paintings of the 1800s and 1900s, really good quality. So if you want to study, now a lot of the paintings are highly photographed. The British and the Met, and they have beautifully photographed paintings where they've lit them with a raking light so you can sort of see brush strokes.
Right.
So, yes, we use books a lot to... it looks like we're coming towards the end.
Okay.
We use books a lot to study, and we do master copies, trying our best. This last year I did a master copy of Bonnard because the painting was in a show at the SAM. So I was actually able to go down, look at it, photograph it, go back, paint it. I wasn't able to paint. You're not allowed to take wet mediums into the museums. So it's not like I'm painting right in front of it, but
right. That
was the best I can do.
And you have accumulated a number of books so that you have a chance to learn about the artists. And while maybe a photograph in a book isn't going to fully represent the painting, it's a good way to at least get a sense of what an artist's work is, and then also what their life and philosophy is about the work that they're doing. And it's wonderful to me that even though things like photographs of Coca-Cola cans became considered art, somehow this wonderful discipline of painting with oil paints and painting in a painterly way didn't completely disappear off the face of the earth. And there's almost kind of a resurgence, it seems.
Yeah,
as though.
Yeah, there was a very thin thread in Florence, basically, that kept it alive with Florence Academy and Cecile's Academy and Angel Academy.
Okay, well, we have probably exhausted our time, so quickly just mention the three titles of the books that we have sitting on the table in front of us.
Odd Nerdrum Paintings, and I'm not going to tell you, Hansen and Kuspit, and then Kitsch, More Than Art, and this is the one that has his writings about Kitsch, and Odd Nerdrum and others, because he's sort of founded a school in Norway. And then Crime and Refuge by Odd Nerdrum.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming and sharing your beautiful art books and teaching us about an artist that we might not otherwise have discovered.
Well, good. I hope everybody goes online.
Okay.
And I hope you go to your library and insist that they purchase some of these beautiful books.
Okay, thank you, Courtney.
You're welcome.